again gather our attention with a breathing space. Finding a posture that really embodies both a sense of groundedness and awakeness, uprightness. And then this first phase is simple but profound gesture of asking what's happening in the mind and in the body in this moment. Mood, thinking patterns, body sensations. Knowing them with an interested, kindly, non-reactive presence of mind. And then the second phase, gathering the attention, maybe using the sensations of breathing in the abdomen, or in the nose, or if it feels more supportive, the sensations of sitting, but choosing a place to gather the attention. Really to connect with the intimacy of sensations as they change. Moment by moment, breath by breath. And then the third phase of the breathing space, expanding the awareness around the breathing to include the whole felt sense of the body as it sits here, and the space around the body. Maybe dropping in that reflection, body as body. And then you're ready, bringing this embodied awareness back into the experience of seeing, or a wider sense of the room as you open your eyes. Some of you will be familiar with the really helpful book, Mindfulness, Diverse Perspectives, that was edited by John Kabat-Zinn and Mark Williams. And it was originally an edition of a journal that John started called Contemporary Buddhism. And it's so helpful, I think, for anybody who's engaged in teaching mindfulness or practicing mindfulness. So Mindfulness, Diverse Perspectives, and it's a series of papers from Buddhist practitioners and psychologists, and really looking at the interface of the Buddhist understanding of mindfulness and the secular understanding of practice.
Is that a book or is that a journal?
It's a book called, the journal has been turned into a book.
Because I've seen the journal.
Yeah. The journal has been turned into a book. So mindful that if you just Google or whatever you use, Mindfulness Diverse Perspectives, come up here. And in there are two really helpful papers, but two that I just wanted to mention by John Teasdale and Michael Shaskelson. And in one of them, in the second of them, they look at what changes in the move into a mindful mode. What does mindfulness shift? And they've identified three particular shifts. The first is what we give attention to. The second is how we pay attention. And the third is the view of what we're attending to. So what we give attention to might be from ruminative thinking to the feeling of the breathing. So a shift in becoming intentional with our attention. How we pay attention is really looking, above all, at the flavouring of the attention. And the shift from aversion towards a sense of kindness, and that's what I'll speak about in a moment. The third is from treating thoughts and experience as fact and as self, to treating it more like mental events, mental and physical events coming and going. And I really like that sort of scheme that they've set out there. I think it's very helpful just in personal practice and also in the reflection on teaching. And when we think about this issue of how we pay attention, we see more and more, and the research is really, and I'm sure a lot of you are aware of this, really endorsing this, that the ethos of mind that we cultivate in our lives makes a huge difference. You know, and really just as a question for each of us, you know, what ethos of mind am I cultivating? What ethos of mind am I cultivating internally and also externally? And you know, what ethos of mind do I want to create in the classes or in the consulting rooms that I work in? And the Buddha identifies, he drew on an existing map, which really identifies four qualities that are profoundly helpful as an ethos to cultivating one's mind. These are the four Brahma Viharas. And the Brahma Vihara, that term means dwelling of the gods, which points to it's the fact that it sort of pre-existed the Buddha. But I like Sharon Salzberg's translation of it as our best home. So what qualities of mind am I dwelling in? What qualities of mind am I making my home in? And these four qualities, and this will be very familiar to many people here, and for all of us, we can just be cultivating them while we're just reflecting on them. The foundational quality is this quality of metta, which John was translating as boundless friendliness. So a basic friendliness that no longer distinguishes between the Vedana, if you like, pleasant and unpleasant, or neutral. It's boundless in the sense that it includes all experience and all people, whether I find them pleasant or unpleasant, or as we, neutral, which includes most of the world's population, who I don't know. So this sense of cultivating a friendliness towards people as the basic default of the mind. And really we're seeing more and more just how facilitative that is of change, and how the absence of that friendliness is so impeding of change, because generally what's in its place is aversion. And this quality of metta is the, as I say, the default. And the other qualities, the two next qualities of compassion and of appreciative joy, are what happens when that basic friendliness encounters suffering and encounters joy or happiness or something uplifting. So when this friendliness encounters suffering, it morphs into compassion. And, you know, a reflection for each of us is, you know, I have that experience. What enables that sense of the arising of compassion? And in the Buddhist tradition, in the Pali canon, there are two words for compassion. One is the word anukampa, which means to cry out at the crying of another. It points to a quality of empathy. Sometimes it's translating as to quiver with. Or even a translation I really appreciate from some psychotherapeutic traditions is to resonate with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that sense of the a really key part of compassion is to have that quality of resonance, that openness of mind that allows us to be touched. Which really points to the importance of listening, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And just how valuable it is as mindfulness teachers and therapists and mindfulness practitioners to have a basic attitude of listening as our home. A receptivity that means that we are sensitive to what's in the field. The field of relationship in the class or the consulting room, or the field that's in our own body, you know, a sense of listening to the body. Often we can have a sense of attention that's quite sort of pointed and going to get something. What is it in this moment? Just to sort of have a sense of receiving the sensations of the body, however they happen. So this quality of anukampa. And then the other word is the word karuna, which comes from the Sanskrit for to make or do or to turn outwards. And I think it points to the sense of, in compassion, this complementary gesture, which is to go out to meet suffering and to seek to alleviate it in some way. And I like to reflect how I think, you know, it's easy, isn't it, to have a fix-it mind in mindfulness teaching or in psychotherapy, where we want to get rid of somebody else's, you know, the unbearability of somebody else's problems, or even the sort of good-hearted desire to help alleviate suffering can mean that we go out and try to fix and sort and come up with strategies so easily. And actually, how much more mature it is in those moments when we're able to have a sense of receptivity and a deep listening and to let, you know, to be able to be with the suffering of another person without having to try to sort it out. To trust that basic quality of a present moment awareness, compassionate awareness. And to sense that the responses that come from that place tend to be more attuned, don't they? They tend to be more attuned to the circumstance. And sometimes they come with a sense of trust that actually listening is enough. And really the body is so integral in this, because we can feel, can't we, how the body is this very sensitive field that picks up what's going on in relationships with other people. And to sense how the body resonates with experience of all sorts, doesn't it? And so to let the body be, if you like, I sometimes like imagine a cello or a piano or something, one of these instruments that has a resonating chamber with it. And that sense of what is it to let the body in our mindfulness teaching or in our conversations with our spouse or our child or our friend or our colleague, just to let the body be present as a sensitive resonating chamber that really is present for this other person and feels what's here. And then, this third quality of mudita or empathetic joy, sympathetic joy, is sometimes translated. I think John and I both like the translation appreciative joy, which is that sense of encountering something uplifting or beautiful or joyful and being able to resonate with that. You know, letting our hearts be uplifted by that. And again, I think that's not a sort of, oh, it's a nice bit of sort of topping on the cake in spiritual practice. You know, it's so often in practice, it feels as though there's a dynamic between resource and edge. You know, edge, the edge of difficulty, the edge of dukkha. And often we can have a sense of, well, the work is really on the edge of difficulty. And that colludes with the evolutionary tendency to try to fix it, you know, that I have suffering and I need to spend my time working on my suffering or helping this other person do that. But do we each know, as mindfulness practitioners and teachers, how really to be resourced and nourished by practice? Really to reflect on and bathe the mind in what is uplifting and nourishing and supportive. And again, using the body for that. So maybe this sense of, you know, the parts of the body, the feet on the floor, the sense of sitting on the chair, the sense of the breath as nourishing. And really to, you know, turn towards what we can appreciate and let the heart be nourished by. And this is, I think, a really big part of practice. Because so often we come to the difficulties in our life undernourished. Mm-hmm. You know? And if we reflect on what resilience is, I think resilience in a certain way is about building a sense of capacity. The Buddha described it as a bit like having a lump of salt, putting it in a glass of water. And he said, you know, if you drink from the glass of water, it's undrinkable, you know, it's so bitter. If you put it in a clear lake, or I think he used the image of the river Ganges, which once upon a time, you know, if you put it in a vast area of water and it dissolves, the water is drinkable. And I think this, you know, points to the quality of joy or resource or capacity that we are cultivating in our heart. Does that make sense? Can you feel it? You know, so often we come with a glass of water, you know, to our difficulties, and or to our mindfulness teaching or our mindfulness practice. And I think really to have that sense of how to nourish the heart, what nourishes the heart, and to make that an integral theme in our daily practice. John mentioned gratitude earlier. You know, gratitude journals are a way of doing that. But also using the body, using that which is steadying or grounding or uplifting or nourishing in the body as a way of building this sense of capacity and enlarging our pool of water. Breath and how it comes to be so central in practice. And certainly in the Satipatthana Sutta, it's the first practice that's mentioned in mindfulness of the body. And John may want to come in on this in a moment, but that sense of you know, knowing the breath, knowing the short, you know, the long breath, knowing the short breath, breathing in sensitive to the entire body. So that sense of being able to feel the breath moving through the whole body, breathing in calming bodily formations. And there's a sense in that section of the breath as nourishing and calming and steadying. And certainly if you look at the Buddha's Sutra on mindfulness of breathing, there's a lot of emphasis on joy, on contentment, happiness, and again, the nourishing qualities of mind to come through mindfulness of breathing. And, you know, it may well be that in secular mindfulness, there's an inadequate focus on those calming, nourishing practices in a certain way. And again, this is something we... And what is it to experience the breath through an appreciative lens? You know, when I'm breathing, it can be just a sense of appreciation, you know, which again can be calming and supportive. So this third quality of pantheon.
I was just going to say that.
So this third quality of mudita or appreciative joy, looking at what, you know, nourishes and uplifts the heart, very key, I think, in practice. And the fourth of the Brahma Viharas is the quality of upekkha, or equanimity. And it's that which balances the mind. It's that which makes the other qualities boundless. Because equanimity is, you know, precisely about this ability to be with the changing Vedana in a non-reactive way. To stand equally near all experiences, as Christina Feldman puts it. You know, to be able to stand equally near the pleasure and the pain and that which is neither. Which is what we're called to do as mindfulness teachers and psychotherapists. But it's also what we're very much called to do as mindfulness practitioners, isn't it? To bring that same interest, kindness, discernment to all experiences. And that's how Christine now defines mindfulness. She says it's the willingness, her definition of mindfulness is the willingness and capacity to stand equally near all events and experiences with kindness, interest, and discernment. And so this quality of equanimity that really is the cool head that balances the warm heart that we're cultivating. And I do think, just like in a certain way, Carl Rogers' core conditions have provided for several decades the sort of foundational attitudes for counselling and psychotherapy work. I do think these Brahma Viharas actually are so valuable as the foundational conditions for mindfulness work and mindfulness training and teaching. They're such, you know, the more they can become the ethos of our practice and of our lives, it facilitates so much, and the whole of human experience somehow can be contained within them. John, do you want to come in on the
problem? I'll say a few words, yeah. Okay, just a few words. About the Brahma Viharas. The Brahma Viharas are, I think, central to the whole of what we do in mindfulness work. Particularly the key one, which I think is the heart of practice, which is this friendliness. I do make a plea, because for the use of the term boundless friendliness, because actually the traditional standard translation of it as loving kindness just doesn't fit the bill. It's too slushy. Because the actual word that's used in... what's a pen? Yeah, the actual word that's used in the Pali is a translation of the Sanskrit word maitri, or maitri, which means to befriend. And it comes from a root which means to befriend. And I think there's something very fundamental about this, because the traditional standard translation of loving kindness, not only does it do a disservice, I think it also implies doing something what we're not actually required to do. It's actually saying, can you stand close, as Chris put it in his kind of way that Christina speaks about this, can you stand close to experience, not necessarily like it, but still acknowledge it and be friendly towards it. And you could think of this actually in terms of the relational world, the world of humans. Can you stand next to that colleague who really irritates you, but still behave respectfully towards them and still treat them with a degree of friendliness, but not necessarily like what they stand for or what they're doing in this? You're not being required to love them. I might point that out. There's a big, big difference there. They are so central. In fact, I would actually say there is no distinction between the practice of metta and the practice of sati. In fact, in something, I won't read it to you, it'll be too long, but in something called the Metta Sutta, which is actually part of the very ancient, part of the most ancient part of the Pali Canon, we have this sutta which just deals with this one particular thing. And in that, there is a claim, for example, by the Buddha, there is no greater form of mindfulness. This is the best way of being in this world. And what he's talking about is not the mindfulness of the secular world that we're talking about, but talking about metta. He's actually talking about this quality of befriending experience and that which is around. He also, interestingly enough, points that it's a path to liberation in the Metta Sutta. I mean, if anybody wants interested, I can point you to an article where this is argued much more fully than I can ever do in this. But it's an extremely important part. It's the heart of the practice. Remember, I don't know if you remember and recall what I was saying in some of the instructions, that actually this gentle turning towards experience is the most basic act of befriending that you can give yourself. Mm. Yeah? You don't even have to do it specifically as an explicit practice, but just in that gentle act of turning towards the difficult, which I know is problematic for some people, this term, but turning towards a bumpy ride off of experience that we engage in. To do that, rather than actually evade it, repress it, which is often what we do, those are not our normal strategies, like divert our attention from something, we end up feeding whatever it is that we're turning away from. So if you really want to befriend yourself, then turn towards it, because otherwise it will catch up with you. And that is really what's quite important. And karuna, which Chris rightly says, you know, is derived from the root of action, what's usually translated as compassion, is really not something any different from the basic metta. It's actually metta in action. Yeah. It's an activity. The word karuna comes from kriya. Kriya means to act. It's action, basically. So metta and karuna are actually not anything to do with feelings. Mm. You know, and I think we ought to get this really, really clear. They're about intentions. The intention to turn the mind towards befriending. It doesn't mean I have the feelings of friendliness at this stage. And certainly not in the beginning stages of it. You won't necessarily have the feeling, but it's that constant attempt to turn the mind towards something which is much more wholesome. And if any of you delve into any of the Buddhist texts, you'll find that the Buddha constantly reiterates that which you turn your mind towards will become the shape of your mind and thus the shape of your life as well. So if we constantly turn our minds, often unwittingly, unthinkingly, towards greed, hatred and delusion, well, no wonder we get the shape of the lives that we do have. So this is a deliberate attempt, a conceptual reframing attempt, to turn our minds towards something which is much more wholesome. And hopefully for it to become, I'll come to it in a second, hopefully it will become the shape of our lives. And I almost consider that these four factors of the Brahma Vihara, starting with metta, can be conceived of as some kind of round dance. You know, all four interacting with each other, not separately. This is made very clear, actually, in a quotation from a 14th century Tibetan, where he says, "Let the beautiful bloom of compassion grow out of the soil of friendliness. Water it with tears of joy and shelter it under the cool shade of the tree of equanimity." Yeah. Showing you the dynamic interrelationship between all of these four factors. They're not without risks, and this is something Chris hasn't touched on, probably for time reasons, but I just want to touch on very briefly. It's not without risks developing these qualities, because there are what are called near enemies of all of them. In other words, the near enemies actually look and almost appear to be the real thing. They're like the counterfeit coinage of the real thing. And so in terms of, for example, friendliness, we get attachment. Instead of friendliness, we end up in a place of attachment, of clinging to someone or something. Instead of kindness or compassion, what we get is sentimentality, which is a very, very real danger, particularly if you associate it more with feeling rather than action. As many of you probably realise, I mean, compassion itself isn't always soft and gentle. Sometimes it has a hard edge to it. And the most commonly used example, one I always use, is when you shout at your child to stop it putting its hand in somewhere it shouldn't, like a fire or whatever it might be. You do it not out of anger, but it appears like it's anger, but it's actually compassion. which is motivating that. That's the intention behind the act in those instances. So compassion isn't always soft, it has that hard edge, but it does have the danger of associating it purely with feeling of dropping over into just mere sentimentality. I think Oscar Wilde had the most brilliant description of the sentimentalist. He said the sentimentalist is a person who doesn't make the effort to have the luxury of a real emotion. Yeah. In other words, it's an easy route to drop into sentimentalism, whereas actually to move into Karuna or Anukampa, this pulsating along with, this feeling with, is much, much more difficult. Mudita, I often translate just as joyfulness. Yeah. Just as, actually, it comes from the root again in the original language, which means a gentle joyfulness that permeates life. And it's about good fortune. It's about the good qualities that you perceive in others' lives, even if it's not present in your own at this present moment in time. And it's the ability to take, in a sense, a taste of joy because there is good fortune around you, even if you're not partaking of the moment. I would actually even extend this to ourselves in the practice of gratitude, as I suggested earlier on, because I think it's really, really important sometimes to actually see that there are joys in our own lives. You know, even when things are rough and difficult, that there are often joys present. But, you know, for example, even if you've got a severe pain, there's an awful lot of your body that's perfectly okay, that's working perfectly all right. There might be, as I say, difficulties in other areas of life, but another part of life is going perfectly fine. You know, and we really need to take stock and actually, in a sense, come into a relationship with that which allows that to, in other words, dispense its joyfulness to us, you know, allowing us to touch that and come closer to it. There is a near enemy of that, and it's elation. You know, getting overexcited about everything.
Intoxication,
yeah, that would be another way of putting it. But it's over-elated. You know? Remember, it's this gentle joy that runs through life. It's not getting overexcited, you know, which we can so easily do. Yeah. It's interesting that the equanimity, well, what is equanimity really? It's a balanced and poised ability to move in an engaged way through both the good things and the difficult things in life. This is what it is. It's not disengagement. So many people see equanimity as a kind of cold staring in at life without being fully engaged in it. And this is not what it means. There is actually a synonym. The word, as Chris rightly says, is upekkha in Pali. But there's also a synonym, which is tatramajatata. It's a big Pali word. It actually means being in the middle of.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Tatramajatata, to be in the middle of things, to be in the middle of life and to be engaged with it, but without being knocked either way, without being, I would say, a kind of pinball in life's game, just being knocked around and flipped from position to position. So this is what's important about it. However, equanimity has a near enemy. And the near enemy of upekkha is upekkha, interestingly and partly. Which actually translates in this instance as a near enemy as apathy.
Mm.
Yeah. So in other words, what we're saying is there is equanimity and there's something that looks very, very much like it, which is actually I couldn't care less. I'm really not engaged at all. So the really distinguishing feature of the equanimity that's being spoken about is this engagement. It's an intense engagement. It's a curiosity. It's almost a word that's almost taboo in Buddhism, but I actually think it's really important, which is a passion. Yeah, a passion of engagement with life. And that is one of the distinguishing features, I think, of the equanimity that's being spoken of. But without dropping into the elation of the overjoyfulness, yeah, without dropping into sentimentality, and without naturally moving towards attachment. All of these actually are arranged in such a way that they antidote each other. Yeah? That they don't, for example, if we take the elation, that's there as the near enemy of joyfulness, then we can get, for example, equanimity, that balance, as a way of calming down the elation. If we have the joyfulness, then it can calm down the sentimentality that so easily compassion can slip into. The kindness or the compassion antidotes the attachment. And finally, the friendliness antidotes the apathy. Yeah. These are at the heart of the practice. They really are the heart of the practice, both literally and metaphorically. First of all, the cultivation of the soil. What we do is we plant the seeds of the possibilities of compassion in our lives by cultivating that soil of friendliness. And we do it in such a way that, for example, if I can find a quote, here we go, that it actually is important for others as well as ourselves. And I just want to finish personally on this, which is, the Buddha is asked the question, how do you look after yourself? He says this, he says, looking after oneself, one looks after others. Looking after others, one looks after oneself. How does one look after others by looking after oneself? By practicing mindfulness, developing it, and making it grow. How does one look after oneself by looking after others? By patience, non-harming, friendliness, and caring. I think I'll leave it at that.